With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm very well respected within comedy and also kind of looked at as sort of a mom to everyone. I'm everybody's mother, which is a nice thing too.
Hello and welcome to the 38th episode of Varvet International. I'm your host, Christopher Triumf, and I'm recording this in Varvet's home in Vällingby, Sweden. But it was recorded a few weeks ago in Los Angeles, Varvet's sort of second city.
Ladies and gentlemen, Margaret Cho!
Everybody, welcome to Gotham Comedy Live. I have an Asian friend here that I bowed to. Is that your boyfriend? Your husband? Oh, he handsome? No, he's real handsome because you know when you see, that's really good because you know when you see like, because you're really beautiful, beautiful Asian woman. And it seems like, you know, like whenever I see like a beautiful, beautiful Asian woman, she's always with the most busted face, broke down, white man. You know what I mean? You know what I'm saying? Like, and I'm like, bitch, are your eyes that small?
Yes, today's guest is the fantastic stand-up comedian Margaret Cho, one of the funniest people in America or in the world. And she also has one of the longest resumes I've ever seen, and maybe that comes with the territory as her career is almost 30 years long and she's been in the top since, well, forever. She's written a couple of books, been a fashion designer, she's done music, been in movies, starred in several TV series, among which we'll soon mention All American Girl, but she also appeared in 30 Rock playing Kim Jong-il. And there's tons of stand-up comedy with her out there, making her one of the not just funniest, but also most successful comedians in the US. And in a while, I'll also kind of bluntly ask her about her sobriety. That's in a half an hour or so. But that has to do with the fact that she has been really open about her personal life. She has talked earlier about struggling with eating disorders as well as drugs and alcohol. And she also has been an advocate for gay rights and have talked about being bisexual and so forth. So, you know, I like long interviews. This one is one of the shorter ones. We were a bit late and Margaret had something afterwards. So my time with her in her super cool Glendale villa was limited. That being said, here is the interview. Roll the tape, please. Here we are. I'm sorry for being late.
Oh, I'm. You're not late, actually. You know, I find people from Sweden hate to be late, almost as much as German people hate to be late. I tend to think Swedish people punish themselves for lateness.
That
it's more internal.
Yeah, we hate ourselves.
So you turn it inward, and then it's very, very dark.
How would you say that Koreans are with self-hatred?
I don't know. I think we sort of are more xenophobic, which I think is the same kind of thing. So it's
you look sort of push
the hatred outward somehow. Okay. Maybe it's a self-defense thing, but it is self-hatred too. But Koreans are usually just more drunk.
Okay. Yeah.
Actually, I think that's like we're the most drunkest of Asians.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
But so how are you today?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
That's nice to hear.
Yes.
What have you been up to so far?
I spent the morning with the LA Times doing a video piece, that is sort of a news documentary they're doing about white girls
Okay.
So we're talking about race and how white people are affected by the racial conversation and how it's just a difficult place to be in. So just doing lots of heavy thinking.
And if you, the listeners wonder what's with this sound, I have Lovisa here. She's my producer. And yes. You have?
My publicist, Ken.
Ken,
and
yeah.
My dogs, Gudrun.
Yes.
Gudrun. And
where did you come up with these names?
Gudrun is a name that I always liked. And I think there's a lot of Swedish people named Gudrun.
Exactly.
It's a beautiful name. And it's just one that I am attracted to. I think it's from the characters from the D.H. Lawrence novel, Women in Love. One of them is named Gudrun, and the other one is Ulrika. But my other dog also has a—I think it's more Danish. Her name is Dagmar.
Yeah, but that flies in Sweden as well.
Oh yeah, it's very common. They're beautiful names, but Dagmar is named after an American actress from the 1950s.
All right,
who was a sort of a burlesque sort of sensation, and then Bronwyn is my oldest dog, who's in the kitchen because it's hot, so she's not walking around right now.
No, she was really, the other ones were really like on their toes when we came here.
They're excited.
Yeah. But the old one, sorry, her name was?
Bronwyn.
Bronwyn.
Yes.
What kind of name
That's
is that?
That's a Welsh name.
Uh-huh,
that's
right.
A Welsh name as my first dog, that was her brother. His name was Rafe, which is also a Welsh name.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. And you are a dog person?
I am. Okay. I am. I really love them.
How come?
I think because they're just very bonded to humans, and they're very, I don't know, I have a relationship with dogs they don't have with other animals. I love all animals, but dogs seem to have the capacity to really return that love, whereas other animals don't have that sort of domesticity. I love cats too, but I'm allergic to them. So my only experience with sort of domesticated animals is dogs.
Okay. I'm thinking that if we are to sort of explore your you, I mean, you were born in 1968.
Yes.
You were born in San Francisco.
Yes, yes.
What do I need to know about San Francisco to understand you?
San Francisco at that time was receiving a pretty big influx of immigrants from Korea. And so when my father came to America in the 60s, he just was part of this big wave of immigration. And there were some issues with his immigration, so he was deported. But when he returned, there was a real emphasis on making me as American as possible so that I would not speak Korean or would not have a Korean accent in anything I did. There was a need to make me as American as possible to sort of maybe combat that idea that I might be less American. So I've always felt very American growing up. And my family owned a bookstore in the 70s and the 80s in San Francisco, which was catering to the gay community. And so I grew up around a lot of gay people. And gay people were very politically progressive and tattooed and very influential. Also, like Armistead Maupin was part of my upbringing then, who was the author of Tales of the City, which is a big, very famous book about San Francisco and gay society in the 70s. So I grew up around a lot of gay culture and saw so many different changes within the community because in the 80s, AIDS happened, which was such a huge plague for the community. And so I watched the community really endure so much suffering and then really only this year really return with a real celebration with the legalization of gay marriage. And so, you know, I guess I've seen a lot happen in gay history, and I'm proud of that, too. So those are the things that sort of make me very San Franciscan.
How come your parents ended up owning a bookstore?
I think my family wanted to be more literary. My father is an author, and so he wanted to...
Yeah, he wrote, like, some kind of joke books.
Yeah. So he was very interested in writing and still is very interested in writing. And so he wanted me to live a kind of a literary life and learn about art and culture from gay people because he felt that that was really the source of how you could really enjoy society is to enjoy it as a gay man would enjoy art and music and literature and everything. So that's my upbringing, really.
And you worked there?
Yes, I grew up there and I worked there and enjoyed this really very rarefied look at gay society before it shifted, before AIDS came. Because in the 70s, when my parents first took over the store, the street that it was on was the Polk Street area, which was a very, very busy area, was just where all of these gays and lesbians were coming from all over the world to finally find acceptance. And so it was this incredibly exciting time. And then when AIDS took over everything, it was so traumatic and difficult. So I saw a community at its most vibrant and most alive, and then the death of it, in a sense. So I witnessed a lot of it. So that's, you know, sad but good. So I can see things in more of a historical context now, like how things have shifted.
Looking at your comedy, it's very essential to you that you sort of have a Korean heritage.
Yes.
Or, yeah.
Yes.
And your father seems to be interested in humor as well, or?
Yes, yes, he is. Well, he's interested in all kinds of writing. And so I guess that's sort of me too. I'm definitely interested in all different kinds of writing, not just being a humorist, but also tackling some more difficult subjects. So in my shows, I talk about racism and I talk about sexism and homophobia in a way that sort of could be more serious, but then I try to make it funny. You know, I think comedy has a place in that conversation, or all those conversations.
Yes, of course. By the way, I have to say, I might have forgotten, I'm very honored and happy that you wanted to have us here.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for coming. I'm excited too. It's great.
And it's so kind of you to let us into your house. It's very, how should I say, it feels eclectic.
Yes. It's kind of a bit of everything. You know, I travel all over the world, so I collect things, and then also things that I have amassed in my work. So a lot of gifts. I have a lot of friends who are artists who have given me things. So it's a nice collection of different kinds of art.
I haven't seen someone with a blue roof and
it's
purple walls before.
Yeah. The blue is, well, this is an eating room. All of the eating rooms, which is this room and the, so it's a dining room and there's sort of a smaller kitchen room. The blue is actually an appetite suppressant.
Uh-huh, it is.
But it encourages communication.
Yeah, it is a suppressant. Okay, so you don't want to eat so much.
You don't want to eat so much, and then you want to talk more. So
okay.
That's what the point of that. But it hasn't really worked out.
I read somewhere like 1 million years ago that if food is blue, it means don't eat it.
Yes.
To us, like...
Yeah, it's an acknowledgement that's poison.
Exactly.
Or something.
Yeah.
So that's why I guess it's an appetite suppressant.
Yeah, yeah.
I think.
You seem like you had a good time, like, working in the bookstore. You come from a really, like, loving family, right?
Yes, yes, yes. Very, very, very much so.
On the other hand, your adolescence, I mean, in school and so forth, wasn't so easy.
No. I had a hard time in school. I think I had some difficulty speaking, and so that was part of my problem, is that I had this intense shyness with other children, and I don't know exactly why that is, but I did. And so that was really tough for me growing up. And so I found safety with people who generally were older than me. And that's kind of why I left school pretty young, because I wanted to pursue doing stand-up comedy. I started stand-up comedy pretty early in my life as a teenager. So I was in a rush to grow up and not be a kid anymore.
Did you ever find confidence in school, or was that after?
Oh, it wasn't much till much after. I mean, I found a lot more confidence and I guess an excitement for a living. And I think maybe when I was much, much older, like a late teenager, early 20s, like it was not easy for me growing up. So I'm happy that I got to become an adult.
Because, I mean, you were truthfully bullied, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Why did people let that happen?
I don't think that we had those kinds of ideas. When I was growing up, we didn't have a kind of protective sort of a campaign such as, like, It Gets Better, you know, the Dan Savage campaign to help gay kids in school remember that it does get better as they get older. So we didn't have anything like that. I mean, when I was a kid, we didn't have really ways to talk about sexual molestation. We didn't have ways when I was like a little bit older to talk about date rape or rape at all, that there was this kind of idea that in my upbringing or my adolescence too, that young girls were very sexualized, that we didn't really have the same kinds of social awareness of how to protect children then that we do now. So I think I fell really victim to that. You know, that was a problem. And I think because of that, that made me very shy, very it was difficult for me to talk to people, which is odd because now it's very easy for me to. So I think there's a lot of things that affected me that maybe I would have benefited from if I'd been born later.
Were you funny all along?
I don't know. I hope so. I don't think so. I think I was thinking things. I was so silent. And then when I finally started to share my opinions with people when I was older and more confident, that I finally was able to sort of realize that I could be funny.
Yeah. I know that you were sort of inspired by Joan Rivers early on.
Yes, yes. She was a hugely important figure in my life and also my comedy. I wanted to be like her. And she was my friend later on, and I really enjoyed that friendship. And so, you know, she was a very important force in my life.
Didn't I see a documentary about her that she documented her jokes, right?
Yes, yes. She had them all in a cabinet or a file cabinet.
Something like that.
It's incredible. It's incredible.
Do you do that as well?
No, I don't have that same level of organization. I don't have anything like that. I mean, everything that I've been doing as a comedian has been documented in my comedy specials. I have quite a few of them.
Yeah.
So I have them there, but I don't have them in a file cabinet.
Do you keep documents of ideas in the computer and so forth?
Yes, I have that. And then I have a lot of things written down in journals and, you know, over the years. But most of it is like, just sort of resides in my memory. Like, I think stand-up comedians have a lot of capacity for memory and remembering things exactly. So I have to sort of do them exactly to make the joke work. So I think it's just all in my head. I hope it is anyway.
I've been interviewing quite a lot of Swedish comedians, and it seems like there are different schools in how developed a joke has to be when they try it on stage.
Yes.
The first time. How are you with that?
Well, usually I write jokes on stage. Like, I have an idea and then I'll take it and I'll try to expand on it on stage, because then you have to come up with something. You know, when you're sitting there and writing, you don't have that urgency of having to come up with something. But when you have to bring it onto, like, into performance right away, then you're forced to invent very quickly. And then your mind can do things that you don't expect it to. So hopefully that sort of worked. It has worked, but I just count on that to write jokes in particular.
Yeah, it's been very successful.
Yeah, I think so. But I do have a writing life, too, where I sit down and I do write and try to do different kinds of writing. So there's that kind of document as well.
I also know, back to your sort of upbringing, and I also know that you were thrown out of high school.
Well, a couple of different things. Well, like, I was thrown out of a school that you had to have really good grades to stay in. So I didn't really do anything bad. I just didn't go to class, which is actually really bad because it was a waste of resources. You know, so that place could be given to a much more grateful and deserving student. So I was expelled from that school, and then I went to a school for the performing arts where I did fairly well, but then I didn't really feel like I didn't really want to be around other kids either. And I had teachers who were encouraging me. I had one teacher who would actually sign me up for comedy club shows, for open mics at comedy clubs, which was a really inappropriate thing, I think, now if I look back on it. But actually, I'm really grateful that it happened.
Why was it inappropriate?
Well, you know, these shows were in bars, and, you know, it was not a school thing, you know, but it was definitely to enhance my creative life, which was what I was working at. Well, I was working on in the School of the Arts that I was attending, but it was a little bit over. It sort of stepped over the line of what teachers are able to do with their students, okay, especially for young kids, 15, 16. You know, that's kind of a little bit inappropriate, but really great.
So it was sort of illegal even?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so, because we weren't even supposed to be in the bar there because we were underage.
Is that teacher still around?
Yeah, yeah. She does a lot of different kinds of stuff, but it's great. It's actually really a wonderful thing.
Have you thanked her?
Yes. Yes, I have.
Okay, so you're sort of Facebook friends or something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, yeah, we're actually friends in life.
Okay.
And so we talk, and she's very excited and happy for me, and I'm very proud of our accomplishments, so it's great.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Not sort of going to college and so forth, because you didn't, right?
I didn't, no.
There is a Swedish expression, I'm not sure that it translates, but it's academics complex, sort of that you lack certain knowledge about stuff that you would learn if you would go to, for instance, college.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
Is there a term for it?
There isn't really, just because I think we are so, I don't know, we're always from diverse backgrounds, people in entertainment. So there's like either a lot of education or none at all. And so you never know where people come from. But I definitely have a lack of certain elements into being a really smart person. Like, you want to be fully well-rounded and know about things that you would know about if you'd gone to school, but I didn't have that. So I always feel a little bit behind some of my very educated friends and some of my friends who are, you know, the dean of Harvard and the you know, people who are living in academia. I always feel sort of like inferior to them because they have lived their entire lives in school. But maybe I know things that they didn't know because they were not there. Like, I've learned from living in the world as a very young person without any kind of safety of an institution like a school.
Of course. So, I mean, the brain is sort of equally big, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But what don't you know?
I think I just don't know a lot about
politics.
No, I know a lot about politics, and I do know a fair amount of history. I just don't know, I guess, whatever you would learn in school, whatever gets you a doctorate or something. I don't have that. I don't know what that is.
Mathematics?
Yeah, I don't have any of that.
Okay.
I really don't know anything like that.
You're Asian.
I should.
Yeah, I know.
I really don't know. Maybe I have the aptitude for it, but it's never been tested.
Every time you have to do something here, you have to sort of tick a box, Caucasian, Asian, African-American, mm-hmm. and so forth. Mm-hmm. We don't do that in Sweden. It would be super inappropriate.
Right.
But Americans do. Why do you do it?
Yeah, I think it's like a demographic thing. I think they want to sort of understand. Generally, when I look at sort of racially specific kinds of questionnaires, those things, I think is that they're trying to judge how much money they're putting into something that if it's not the more powerfully economic group that is in generally Caucasians, then they may pay less attention to it. You know, that it's like, who is this opinion coming from? And they want to sort of judge the opinion by how much money you make. And that is sort of directly in correlation to what your racial identity is.
Is that sort of feeding a racist system?
Yes. Yes, it is. But it's also kind of a backwards way of addressing multiculturalism. You know, it's like more of a tracking device than it is anything that I think really helps society. It's so that the government can know where and who is affected by what they're doing, I think.
But during your lifetime, by the way, you are somewhere around 50, right? No, 40, sorry.
46.
46,
yes.
I'm sorry.
No, it's close to 50.
Well.
It's almost 50.
Well. but anyway, during your lifetime, would you say that America is, in general, would you say that it's less racist now than it was when you grew up?
I think America is more aware of its racism than it was when I grew up. I think when I grew up, that racism was really just kind of reserved for this idea that it was somehow dealt with, that we had lived in a sort of a post-racial society, which is not true at all. Now, I think the reason why we're seeing so much racism, especially when it comes to Black people and law enforcement, is because we finally have a way to make the world a witness, that is, with cell phones and just that everybody's able to document what they've been through. So I think the country, America, has always been a racist country, but we've never been aware of the extent of the racism until we were able to actually document ourselves.
Is there a different racism with people of Asian descent?
Yes. The differences in racism have a lot to do with the way that we're perceived by the dominant culture, which is white culture, and also the path of our own immigration here. So we look at the path of African Americans. It's a very violent consequence that brought them here. They were not brought over. It was not like the same way that Latinos were coming here and not the same way as Asians were coming here. So it's a different consequence. So I think that we've absorbed history as a culture and tend to treat the different kinds of civil rights movements as a consequence of their context historically.
Will you live to see a non-racist America?
Oh, I'd love to see that. I'd love to live to witness that. I think it's complicated, but I think it would be really joyous. I would love to think that we're not that far from that. So
Why is that?
Is I think that there's so much of an urgency to fix the world, especially with social media, that there's a need to make things right, that injustice actually is like the main enemy of all people who sort of want to be on social media and their definition of injustice. And so there's an urgency to solve it now that has never really existed before.
How about homophobia? Do you think that will be exterminated?
Yes, I would love to see that. I think that's a really good and exciting journey, too, to see the gay civil rights movement move into an arena where we have the Supreme Court siding with us here, you know, with the legalization of gay marriage and the addition to the Constitution to protect gay rights. I think that's really valuable. So I'm seeing definite steps towards that.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Did anyone raise the question about perhaps, instead of legalization, gay marriage, to ban straight marriage?
I think that's definitely been an argument too. Like people say that marriage in itself is an antiquated idea, which it might be. I mean, I think the more important issue is that whatever it is, we're just trying to find equality in that. So whatever is equalizing is the best.
Perhaps banning stuff is bad for the world as well.
I guess. But I don't think banning the Confederate flag is a pretty good idea.
It might be.
I think that's positive. So some bans might be valuable and important.
Usage of hard drugs?
I think all drugs should be decriminalized. I think that's my take on it. I mean, I feel that drugs and the illicit procurement of them is part of the problem with society, one of the problems. And so I often talk about, I think that pot should be legalized. That's the one country where I really get argument about that is Sweden. Sweden does not like marijuana.
I guess.
They're very like, oh, that's a drug.
Yeah,
that's a drug. And I mean, I went to Stockholm and I was asking for pot, but I was asking for drugs and they're like, oh, what do you want? Do you want G? Do you want K? Do you want GHB? Do you want Coke? Do you want acid? Do you want Molly? And I'm like, oh no, I just want pot. And they're like, oh no. No, but that's drugs. Like that's really drugs. So I don't know. I think pot should be legal, but it's something that is a very controversial idea.
Yeah. Well, not here, right? Not in California. Or
it is and it isn't. You know, I think in general in America, there's people who have problems with it. Unfortunately, there's a lot of people in prison who have marijuana offenses that it's an equal. You know, I think if you're middle class and that you have marijuana offenses, you can sort of get out of it and it doesn't put you in prison. But if you're from a poor background, it definitely is something that affects you. So you see a lot of people in prison with marijuana offenses that are actually really not violent. I don't think marijuana is a drug that should be criminalized. It's just not something that makes people violent,
okay.
I think.
Yeah. Okay, so you wanted to get into stand-up comedy and you sort of pursued that early on.
Yes.
And it sort of took off quite fast as well, right?
Yeah, I think that was lucky and good. And also I worked really hard because I really enjoyed it. And I also didn't want to become a kid again. So I was very determined to just become financially independent and an adult really fast.
I was discussing this with my wife yesterday, that it feels like you were sort of a trailblazer in a way, because had there been any other famous Asian comedians here before you?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that there had been, there was a guy named Johnny Yoon, who was South Korean guy.
He, I haven't heard of him.
He was very much sort of a Tonight Show guy in the 70s. So he was, I think, friends with Johnny Carson. So he was on a lot. And it was always very exciting to see him. But I don't really have any, I don't remember anybody else at that time.
So you were...
I think I was the first.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I was the first.
Are you proud of that fact?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. For sure. Yeah, it's great. It's exciting because I didn't even know that I could have an effect on history. And I really have. So it's really wonderful.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Does that make it easier to go up in the morning?
Yeah, for sure.
It does.
It's good. Yeah, because I already accomplished it. So it's sort of done. I don't really have to do anything else anymore. I'm fine.
Okay, so you truly feel like that?
Yeah, I do.
That sounds fantastic. You must be a really positive person.
I am pretty positive. I try to be. But then again, you know, it's always very much, it's a struggle if you sort of look at the way that show business is, and you're always sort of facing rejection of some kind. So you have to kind of remain positive, even though it's tough.
Yeah, but I mean, in my life, I would say that of all the ideas and all the projects I've sort of embarked on, it's been like perhaps 90 to 10 what failed. I mean, most stuff that I've done has been failures.
Yeah, me too. Like, as artistically, you know, you try to accomplish things, and then, you know, but it's like, I think you're judged by the way that you deal with failure and also the way that you can turn failure around. I think failure is just a stage in development. You know, it's just another step towards what you really, the larger goal is. So,
but do you ever bomb still?
Yeah, totally. And I, you know, definitely have made big mistakes in my career over time. But then those failures have added up to a success because I still continue to pursue it, you know, whatever that was, like whatever my artistic endeavors are, I still kept going forward. So it's all good.
Have you been in doubt that this is what you're supposed to do?
Yeah. I definitely know that this is what I'm very secure in that.
But when did you doubt it the last time? Or?
Oh, I doubt all the time because I take a lot of chances, you know, okay. And I take a lot of risks, and I also sometimes don't care about what the profession is, which is the comedy is the main point is to make people laugh. And sometimes I put that aside in order to make a point about what I'm thinking. And that necessarily isn't the right approach. It's an honest approach, but it's not the right one. You always have to remember what your job actually is. So I have to just remember I'm just an entertainer and I have to just enjoy that. But there's a lot of freedom in that because then if I say something really offensive, it doesn't matter because I'm just an entertainer. It doesn't have the same kind of seriousness as it would if, you know, if it was just a political point of view, you know, because it's all can be a joke. The noble art of comedy is to make people feel better about their lives. And so you always just try to fulfill that first.
But is there, like, if there is something that you feel is super important, I mean, do you work on it until it's funny then?
Yeah, you try to.
Yeah.
You try to, and you try to find a way to talk about it, and you try to find a way to deal with people who don't agree with you. So, and that can be very tough in America because people get really angry because it's such a divided country for so many reasons politically. Like, and I was talking about, in like 2003 and 2004, I was really talking about the Bush administration, and I was very critical of it, very angry about it. I didn't like it, and I didn't like going to war, and I didn't like, you know, this reaction to 9/11 that was going to war, which was not the right choice, I thought. And so that was a really very, very strong position to have then, because there was a really a strong time of real absurd kind of patriotism
after
9/11 and around the Bush administration. Yeah. Like, it's sort of, It did, the patriotism did serve its purpose, but it didn't justify us going to war. So that was my criticism about it. And so I had a lot of problems about that. Like, people were really upset. But then the entire world started to realize that the Bush administration was terrible. And then everything kind of came back around. So it's, you when you are sort of a forward thinker, you can sort of come up with things maybe ahead of the times, and then people get mad.
Who do you think going to win the next election?
I don't know. I like Bernie Sanders. I like Hillary Clinton. I actually know Hillary Clinton socially, which is really weird. She's great. She's really great. Yeah. And she knows what it's like to be president. She's done it. So I think she's very much a viable candidate, as is Bernie Sanders, who's very earnest and really interesting, and I think a good thinker. So we'll see.
Could you elevator pitch Bernie Sanders for me? What's good with him?
He is really about equalizing society, and that's acknowledging the racism that we are seeing now, especially as it relates to the police and Black people. He's also really trying to get people to understand the difference in the way that we're taxed, the tax brackets that we're in, how much more expensive it is to be an American if you are poor or middle class than it is if you're very, very rich. Mm. So he's trying to expose the inequality in the way that we pay our taxes, in the way that we're treated by the government. And I love that approach to this office, which is really about equalizing things. I think Obama's done a great job. I worked on his campaign when he became president. So I am aware of some of the machinations behind what it takes to become the president. I think Bernie Sanders is a little bit too honest in a lot of ways, because he's really telling the truth about what America has been doing all these years. And I think that might be scary to other people in office who would mostly probably support him if he wasn't sort of exposing everything.
Okay. Does he have a chance?
I think if it's more couched in some kind of establishment, that's why I think he would be good with Hillary Clinton, because she is both part of the establishment and somebody that's really fighting for equality and has been for a long time.
I'm sorry that I sort of pulled you into politics. I was going to go into more of the stand-up comedy world.
Mm-hmm.
You started out early on and so forth, and then at some point you moved to L.A.,
Yes.
Why?
I wanted to do comedy on television. At that time, this is the very early 90s, there was a lot of stand-up comedy on American television. So you had MTV running it and Fox at that time, which was a new network. And then you had like all these different television specials on cable that were starting. So I wanted to be part of that. And I got work right away with that. And then also I started to get deals to do my own television show, which became eventually a male All-American Girl in 1994. So that sort of brought me here more permanently. But I was also always on the road too and working. So I just wanted to make LA my home base so I could do more television comedy and then work on my deals and my TV show and also go on the road from here.
At the same time, as you did this, did you go through a hard time personally?
Oh, well, when I was doing All American Girl, it was very difficult because part of the problem was that they always thought that I was too fat to play the role of myself. So then I was like trying to lose weight, but I couldn't really do it. And I was doing it wrong and I ended up getting very sick. And then the show was eventually canceled because it was not really representative of my comedy, because I was a much more edgy comedian, but they wanted to have more diversity in TV where there was no diversity at that time. So it was a difficult time to actually try to do a show that had an all-Asian cast. And now, you know, it's taken 20 years, which is a show now on TV called Fresh Off the Boat, which I'm really excited about and proud of. And then another show coming up called Dr. Ken, which is another Asian American family show. And these are my friends' shows. And, you know, this is exciting because now we're finally able to see more Asian people on TV.
And after that, after All American Girl, I mean, what did you take from that?
Well, I felt like it was a huge failure and it was very depressing. And then I was on the road as a comedian all the time. But then in doing comedy, I found a lot of support. You know, like I found that I could talk about my experience and talk about what happened to me in television and really have an audience that was excited to hear it. And so through that difficult experience, through that initial failure, I built a much bigger success as a stand-up comedian. So I really had something to talk about. I really had some suffering to address. I think that's what comedy is most genius at, when you can address suffering in your life and really try to find a way through it and through coping with it. So that's something great to share with other people. So that's where I found my true voice as a comic.
Yeah. And finding your true voice, is that sort of, because I've dabbled in the art of stand-up comedy myself. And what I tend to think about my material is that it feels too written. I mean, I could sort of give it to anyone,
mm-hmm.
and they could perform it and perhaps get a laughter.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't resonate with myself.
Mm.
How do you get to that point?
I think it takes a long time, actually. It takes many tries to sort of figure out what voice is authentic to you and what is your message. You know, like, because it's hard to really understand what your message is as a comedian until you do it for, I think, at least a decade. You got to do it for like 10 years and then you kind of figure it out. It takes a while.
Yeah, 10 years is a lot of time.
It took me about 10 years to figure it out, to really understand what it was that I was supposed to do.
And you're still not perfect.
No, no, no. But it's always, I'm willing to risk that imperfection. And I'm really not a perfectionist, so it doesn't really matter. It doesn't bother me. Like, I just keep going, and I just want to try different things, and I try to do things that are true to me and what would be entertaining. I want to be different, though.
Are you sober?
No, I'm not sober.
Okay.
No, I was sober for a long time, and then I didn't really feel so great about it. You know, I didn't really feel like, oh, I don't know if this is what I want or what I need. I'm not sure. And then when I went back to drinking and smoking pot, and which is sort of pretty benign, I think, it didn't really destroy my life. I mean, my problem with drugs and alcohol had a little bit more to do with anorexia and bulimia, which was mostly my issues during All American Girl, because I was forced to diet and try to be thinner, and I couldn't really handle that. And so I was often turning to drugs and alcohol so I wouldn't eat. And so after I was sober for a long time, and then just able to sort of eat whatever, I don't know, everything sort of equalized, was normal. So I'm not sure. I think sobriety helps people. I think it probably would help me at some point. It did help me when I was, but I don't know what it would do for me now.
But how long did you stay sober for?
About 10 years.
Okay.
Everything's in 10 years.
That's
increments.
A long time.
Yeah. A long time.
In the stand-up comedy world, I mean, you are, at least from my perspective, you are one of America's most successful comedians.
Yes.
Is that true?
Yes.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic.
It's great. Thank you.
Is there a hierarchy? I can't say that word.
Hierarchy?
Yes,
there is. There is a hierarchy in comedy that it's generational. It's also fueled by our media outlets, like who has a show, who's got a show. They're generally out in front more. But I've been around for long enough, and I'm one of the rare exceptions in the comedic world where both comedians like me and audiences like me. So it's a kind of, it's a good place to be in. I'm very well respected within comedy, and also kind of looked at as sort of a mom to everyone. I'm everybody's mother, which is a nice thing too.
Because you're at the top, sort of.
Yes.
You're always headlining.
Yes.
Where and when do you try material?
Oh, all the time. That's why I bomb all the time.
Okay.
Because I'll take, you know, I'll do an hour show, and then I'll usually spend a little bit of that time really trying to figure something out for myself, which will be new and untested. Pretty much every show I'll do something new. And that's where people would be like, what is that? Like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, this is not. And then you have to kind of go back to sort of what they know you as or what you sort of tried before.
Yeah.
But that's where I would do poorly, but it would only be for a few minutes. So I try something out.
So now that you are about to go on tour,
mm-hmm.
will there be new material every night?
Yes. Yes, because okay. There's always has to be, because something always happens every day. And also the way that we like view the news now, there's stuff that happens minute to minute that you just got to be conscious of, and sort of, because everybody's looking at Facebook and seeing the story scroll. So there's an unbelievable amount of information that people have now that didn't have that before. So now you have to be very conscious of what's happening.
I hope to catch you.
Yes.
On the road.
Please come.
Would you like to recommend something?
I like to put brown rice in tom kha kha soup. It's a Thai soup, but to me it's like a curry. It's so delicious, so I put brown rice. I would suggest that to anybody.
Okay.
It's a good one.
Yeah. Do you have that for breakfast?
No, no, no. That's more of a dinner thing. Yeah. Maybe lunch. Thai food in Los Angeles is very good.
Okay.
It's so if you're looking for that here. I don't know if there's a Swedish restaurant here.
I'm not sure either, but if there was, you wouldn't want to try it.
Anyway. Well, I love all Nordic kind of cuisine.
Okay.
So,
all right.
you know.
You like the pickled herring and stuff?
Well, then I like the sort of Rene Redzepi, Copenhagen, kind of Nordic cuisine. Oh, but I'll take a roll mop.
Okay.
I like that.
Yeah. But maybe if you would pick one restaurant to tip us about in Los Angeles, then.
I would go to Kangho-dong Baekjeong. Kangho-dong Baekjeong. It's in Koreatown. It's this guy who is a Korean comedian who was disgraced because of a tax evasion scandal. So he was forced to come to America and open a restaurant. It's called Kangho-dong Baekjeong. It is literally the best Korean restaurant in the entire world.
Ah, fantastic.
So if you like barbecue, if you like meat, if you like really fresh, beautiful flavors, it's really, really good. And he has a lot to live up to because he was disgraced because of this tax evasion scandal in Korea. He was really the greatest star in Korea and now had to come here and make a restaurant.
Who do you think I should interview on my podcast?
I think you should interview Dr. Ken Jeong. He is a comedian, and he is well-known for his character in The Hangover. He's a really funny guy, and
in Community as well.
He's in Community, yes. Yeah. He's really great, and he's an actual medical doctor, and he has a new show called Dr. Ken that I mentioned before. It's the third Asian-American family TV show ever on ABC, so it's going to start in the fall.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for your time.
Of course. Thank you.
That's Margaret Cho, and she's going out on her There's No I in Team, but There's a Cho in Psycho tour as of right now, and all throughout the fall and winter. So make sure to check out margaretcho.com to see when she comes to your town. She actually is on her way to Europe. Look forward to that. She'll be in Stockholm on December 6th. See you there. And speaking of seeing, don't miss Varvet on Facebook and Instagram. Search for Varvet International on Facebook and on Instagram, where Varvet Pod. Varvet is made by me, Christopher Triumph, and I have some help from Malin Triumph and, of course, my editor, Lovisa Olsson. We're distributed by Acast. Try their app. It's free. Talk to you in 2 weeks. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.